Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones and I'm the Features Director of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of super yachting is Caroline White, our Deputy Editor. Caroline, can you tell us more about this week's interview?
Yeah, so this week our senior editor Sophia Wilson interviewed the environmental advocate and ocean pioneer James Blake. James is the son of the legendary sailor Sir Peter Blake, who is famous not only for his iconic Red Sox, but also for being the only person to compete in the first five editions of the Whitbread Round the World race, and also for helping New Zealand secure two successive victories in the America's Cup. It's actually a shocking story. The yachting world was left saddened when Sir Peter was shot dead by pirates on an environmental mission on the Amazon River in 2001. However, his son has carried on his ocean legacy, and Sophia catches up with him about his work as a videographer, including following in his father's footsteps covering the Volvo Ocean Race and his groundbreaking project to build the world's first kite boat.
Sounds like fascinating stuff. Well, we'll look forward to hearing that later on. Now, devoted subscribers to this podcast will know that Stuart Campbell is usually here with us as well. This week he isn't because he's watching the World Superyacht Awards judging, which is happening literally right now.
Absolutely. So in case you don't already know, what makes our awards special is really our stellar judging panel of current and former superyacht owners who collectively bring with them hundreds of years of experience of owning, running and managing superyachts. Boat International has no say in the votes or pre-selection of the yachts. It's all down to those judges. So usually we unite them in some glamorous location, but this year, for obvious reasons, they're doing it remotely by video call. Although, of course, they're very free to sip champagne on the call. Good luck to the entrants, and we look forward to learning the results in September.
That's a very discerning panel, that. We look forward to seeing who the winners are. But speaking of exciting events to look forward to, boat shows are back. This is big news. So this week, the Venice Boat Show will open its doors to visitors for the first time since its debut edition in 2019. And it's going to be doubling the number of vessels on show to 220. So that's running very shortly from May the 29th to June the 6th. Meanwhile, the organisers of the Cannes Yachting Festival, which is due to run from the 7th to the 12th of September, have said they're confident that that event will go ahead this year as well. Around 600 boats are expected to be shown at the event, with 430 exhibitors already registered and debuts planned up 10% on 2019, so the numbers are up to 140. It's the first time a section of the show will be dedicated to innovation, with several start-up businesses, and boats in the show will range in length from 5 metres to 45.
Yeah, so I think for the really big boats, of course, we'll have to wait until the Monaco show, which is due to happen in September from the 22nd to the 25th. And I think, hopefully, that the superyacht industry might feel like it's getting back to normal by that point. When Monaco happens, you know that things are back on track.
It definitely seems like that's all happening. Every time I speak to someone, they say sort of, see you in Monaco. So I think everyone is assuming it's going ahead, and fingers crossed it does. But yeah, things definitely seem to be kind of getting back to somewhat normal. I was speaking to the PR for EOS this week, a big sort of expedition yacht company, and she mentioned that they've got bookings for charter trips up until about 2024 now. She said they've been super busy. So people are definitely making plans to travel both for the near future and for a few years' time. She said that the areas they were focusing on were Iceland and Scotland, and then in a year or so they're looking at Svalbard and places like that. So it's great to hear, yeah, that people are getting back out there.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine a yacht is probably the best way to visit some of those places. So Svalbard's an archipelago. Scotland has some really spectacular coastline, dotted with distilleries, I should add. And of course, if you're travelling by yacht, that means that you have really beautiful accommodation, even if you're going to the back of beyond.
Yeah, there's something lovely about when you see these quite rugged landscapes and you think, oh, the idea of kind of popping back onto your super yacht for a whiskey and a nice warm fire is very appealing, isn't it?
But absolutely, yeah.
I'm super desperate to get out to Antarctica. That's always been top of my, absolutely top of my hit list. And I've been sort of spurred on by this feature I've been working on for our September issue, which is all about adventure photography. So I've been speaking to some of the world's best snappers. I'm pretty sure they'd hate to be called that. They're photographers, they're artists. But these guys really go the extra mile in already very dangerous destinations to get that perfect, amazing shot. You know, they've been on all the world's most exciting super yachts, and they've been to all the scariest places. And they've got some amazing stories to tell. I dug out a couple of them that sort of made my jaw drop. One was a very famous photographer called Justin Hoffman told me that there was a moment when he was in Papua New Guinea when his leg, a small cut on his leg, was infected by flesh-eating bacteria, which sounds
Oh my God.
I know, it sounds like so terrifying.
Talk about suffering for your art.
I know. I mean, they've all got stories like this. He said luckily his friend was a local and very knowledgeable and had some kind of strong drugs that would keep the bug from getting any worse. worse and he was fine. And there was another one, there's a Danish photographer called Sissa Brimberg, who mentioned a time when she was just about to jump out of the Zodiac in Svalbard and come ashore, when she saw that one of the many big rocks that were all along the shoreline were actually kind of moving. Turns out it was a fully grown male polar bear that was just having a nap and sort of waking up. And she was just about to jump on top of him, and you just think, oh my God, as if these places could be any more kind of thrilling and slightly terrifying. Yeah, they all have stories like that, and they all endlessly talk about how amazing the light is in Antarctica and how you cannot fail to take good photos there. So obviously loads of reasons to go. But anyway, you can read all about that in our September issue, and hopefully you can get one of those guys to come on board, or at least just marvel at their beautiful pictures. So that's it for now about polar bears and flesh-eating bacteria, but time for some news.
Evo Yachts, which is better known for its smaller boats, is launching its largest yacht by some way, the 24-metre V8. She was designed by Valeria Revellini and has been described as sporting a refined, minimalist design. You may be more familiar with Evo's very cool R line of day boats, which feature various elements that slide out automatically at anchor to create a huge aft-deck space. It certainly seems as if the V8 shares some of that convertible nature with what looks like slide-out sections on the already large aft deck. There are a few more unusual surprises on board, and we are planning on running an exclusive feature on this boat in an upcoming issue of Boat International, so you'll be able to read all about those then.
In other news, Cantiere della Marche has delivered the 40-metre explorer yacht, now named RJ, to its European owner. She was built to a design by Francesco Pascowski, with naval architecture by Hydrotech. RJ was specifically designed to maximise time at sea and features plentiful outdoor areas. But most importantly, she offers a range of 5,000 nautical miles at 9 knots, so some excitingly far-flung destinations can be added to her itinerary.
Absolutely. Construction on Southern Wind's first 29-metre hybrid sailing yacht named Nyamba has begun in Cape Town. She's named after the Swahili word for home and is due for delivery in summer 2022. Southern Wind says the owner requested a sexy, comfortable, reliable, sustainable yacht with a sporty soul. Nyamba will feature a hybrid propulsion package developed with BAE systems and will meet all the latest IMO Tier 3 regulations. Her young, hands-on owner is described as a passionate sailor, and Nyamba will be used to sail around the world with limited crew and partake in a number of superyacht regattas. The hull lines were penned by Far Yacht Design, while Nauta Yachts penned the interior and the exterior. She looks like she's going to be a very good looking boat, so we look forward to that.
Absolutely, and I love that brief, sexy and reliable. That's what we're all looking for all the time, I feel.
Exactly.
So lots of great new yachts there to buy. And if you're thinking of making a purchase, you might be interested in this week's data report, as we're going to be looking at the value of super yachts.
So often in this slot we talk about brokerage, but today we're actually talking about new boats. Our estimates here are based on what the average asking price was for different sizes of boats delivered at the time that they were delivered. So doing this, we can see the rough value of all superyachts delivered in a given year. In 2020, for example, the 351 yachts delivered were worth a total of 6.6 billion euros, which works out at an average of 18.8 million euros a yacht. That wasn't too far off 2019, when the average value was 18.3 million euros, but those years were a little down on the previous eight, where the average value of a superyacht delivered lay more around the 19 or 20 million euro mark, with a high of 21.7 million in 2015. In terms of specific size brackets, the average value of a 24 to 30 metre yacht has remained relatively stable over the past decade at just under 8 million euros. The average value of a yacht in the 30 to 40 metre bracket has hovered at just over 14 million, for 40 to 50 metres at just over 21 million, and for 50 to 70 metres at around 45 million euros. The 70 metre plus bracket has seen the biggest fluctuations over the past decade, with average values each year varying from 101 million to 183 million. But there are so few yachts in this category that just one huge and very expensive build has the power to really skew the numbers. So last year's average among 13 boats was 180 million, and I have to say that does not sound bad, considering, as I just mentioned, the high over the last decade for an average was 183 million euros. So looking at the top builder nations, the country whose delivered yachts had the highest average value last year was, unsurprisingly, Germany, with an average price of just over 216 million euros. We can surmise that's because it delivers very few yachts, so just four last year, but very big yachts. By contrast, the UK has the lowest average value at just over 9 million on its 39 deliveries. That's actually even lower than Taiwan's 10.4 million average last year, when usually the UK beats Taiwan a little bit. So something interesting going on there.
Some really interesting points there, and we'll be keeping an eye on that to see how things progress in the coming years, especially given all these new yacht owners on the horizon. Well, that's it for the data story for this week. Stay tuned to hear Sophia's interview with explorer James Blake.
So today I'm delighted to be joined by videographer, environmental advocate and ocean pioneer James Blake. The son of legendary explorer and America's Cup sailor Sir Peter Blake, it's perhaps no surprise that he's been drawn to a career at sea, and his recent work projects have included helping to capture Vista Vescovo's Five Deeps expedition, as well as being an onboard cameraman during the Volvo Ocean Race. In his spare time, he's also the driving force behind the Ocean Kite Project, which aims to build the world's first kite boat using the hull from a former AC-45 America's Cup catamaran. James, thank you so much for being with us today. I understand you're fresh off a plane from the Maldives. Where are you joining us from?
So I'm just back at home now. I landed yesterday down in my house in Emsworth on the south coast of the UK and just started my quarantine period.
Delightful. And how was the Maldives?
It was great. Yeah, I was working on a new big natural history series. So it was great to be able to travel and have some work. And I felt pretty lucky to be kind of overseas, especially in the Maldives at the moment. It was nice, but the work was pretty tough. It was good to be working.
And was it strange being there, presumably, you know, all the hotels and everywhere shut? Was it strange kind of being out there without all that side of it going on?
Well, everything's still kind of open, but there's obviously a lot of countries can't travel. So there's only kind of, yeah, certain people there. But everyone was socially distanced, obviously lots of masks, just as everywhere else. So it was a little bit odd, but it was nice for us because we had to isolate for 10 days as a crew, isolate away from each other, and then we were on board a boat, so it meant that we had our own little bubble. So that was really nice to have a group of people together again where we could actually sit and have dinner and, you know, eat and chat and be normal. It was, rather nice.
With your kind of blue water CV, it's quite hard to know where to begin, really. But let's start at the start. I presume with your father, you're on the water from a pretty young age. What are some of your earliest memories?
Some of my earliest memories were just messing around with dad in the water. He used to have this old kind of windsurfer from the 60s, big old thing. And some of my earliest memories are just from him going out on that and me just grabbing onto the back of it and being towed around the harbour, or messing around in little dinghies as a family, kind of going on mini little expeditions, they felt like that, around the harbour.
And were you drawn to sailing, or did you end up with more of an interest kind of in the kitesurfing, windsurfing side?
I always used to enjoy dinghy sailing, but I kind of shied away from it a bit because having dad on the sidelines, I was always a bit nervous. So if there was any ever breeze, I would always opt to go windsurfing when I was younger. It probably wasn't until I was kind of about 18 or 19 that I got back into sailing bigger boats. So I think, yeah, that's something I'd always kind of built up in my head, even though it wasn't really an issue.
Was he competitive on your behalf or not really?
He was, yes. He was, yeah, pretty competitive. And, you know, it was quite nerve-wracking being his son lining up on the start line. I think that was always, made me a bit nervous, really. So yeah, I think I preferred to, again, as I said, kind of windsurf or kitesurf, as it was kind of, it felt a bit more like my sport.
And he obviously did amazing things and was kind of ahead of his time on the environmental campaigning side. How much do you think that's also influenced the work that you do now?
Yeah, I think it definitely influenced, especially I went and did my undergrad in environmental science and then my master's in science communication. That was very much where dad was heading. That was very much a driver for what I wanted to study. I guess that's how I got into filmmaking as well, was dad would always have kind of cameras around with him. And so that when he started doing his Blake expeditions, he was making films about it. And I was really interested on the environmental side, but also on the camera side. So that's kind of, that was a big driver to what I do today.
And how much, he obviously had some of his biggest victories when you were a child. How much do you remember of them? Were you there to celebrate? What were some of those days like?
Yeah, some of the earlier ones, I was too young, even though I was there, I was too young to remember, like Steinlager, him winning the Whitbread, or now the Volvo. And then I do remember Enza, that was 95. That was around the world winning the Jules Verne. And I remember being at school and kind of tracking him when we'd come home as a family and speaking to him on the phone. And then also being there when he came in and he lifted me up onto his shoulders. And I've got these fantastic memories of walking through the crowds when the photographers, that was really special. And then the two America's Cups, especially the first one in San Diego, we kind of moved out there as a family. So I went to school out there and that was really amazing to kind of, there was a very family orientated feel too. that team. So it was great to be a part of and kind of running around the base and getting involved, probably causing a bit of mischief too.
And do you think the America's Cup still has that family feeling? I kind of get the impression that, you know, it does now, that a lot of families do move out there and they do kind of become part of the team.
It always has done because it's all over the world, so families have had to travel. But I think possibly for the last one, the one that's just been, I reckon it probably did have more of a family feel because, especially with what's going on now with COVID, that everyone would have had to travel out there. And obviously New Zealand's one of the safest places to be. So I imagine it would have been kind of quite a nice feeling for the team. And I'm sure, you know, it helps the teams if they can have the family kind of there and helping.
And I read somewhere that your father said that you weren't allowed to put your elbows on the table until you'd sailed around Cape Horn. You were finally able to achieve that during the Volvo Ocean race in 2018. How special a moment was that?
Yeah, that was fantastic. And yeah, that saying, Dad always used to say it whenever we're eating dinner, I think just so he could put his elbows on the table and none of us could. But going round Cape Horn, it was kind of very mixed emotions really, as that leg a few days before John Fisher had fallen overboard on Scallywag. And so that was quite a dark time for everyone, and kind of, you know, thinking of him and his family. But then once we actually kind of got to Cape Horn, for me, it was somewhere that Dad had talked so much about, kind of these beautiful, fantastic rocky mountains with, you know, and he described them so well. But to actually be there and go around them, it was pretty moving. And I was with Team ExxonMobil then. They were a good team to be with. And so it was a moving time for me and something that I really enjoyed. You know, at the time I did, but it probably wasn't till, you know, a couple of weeks after when it all kind of sunk in.
And can you explain a bit more about what your role? You're an onboard reporter for the Volvo Ocean Race. What exactly does that involve?
So being an onboard reporter for this edition, it was slightly different. So every team has a what they call an onboard reporter, which is a cameraman, and you're on board to document the journey and to send off stories every day, ranging from kind of 2 to 5 minutes long, and a set number of photos, say 15 photos each day. So you're not allowed to help with the performance of the boat, but you are allowed to cook, clean and bail. So you have a bit of a mixed role. And for this edition, we were employed by Volvo and not the teams, which it always has been beforehand. So they decided to try and mix us around so that they could kind of switch us within the teams, which had its ups and quite a few downs. I don't think we'll ever go back to that anytime soon. But it was unique for, I really enjoyed it because you got to meet a lot of people and see how all these different teams worked, which was great fun. And all the sailors are all really nice, you know. It might take a little while to warm up to some or them to you, but usually it was pretty exciting and good fun. And you're just there to try and document what they're going through and of course the race as well.
And were there any particularly kind of hard moments in that when, you know, they were having a difficult leg or something was going wrong, and trying to capture that when people are sort of at low ebb anyway, then sort of trying to ask them questions or have the camera out?
Yeah, there were quite a few moments like that. But if you'd spent enough time with the team, it was, you know, you kind of knew how to handle it. I think one of the first Southern Ocean leg from Cape Town to Melbourne, I was on ExxonMobil then, and they went for a particularly bad jibe with Chris Nicholson on the helm, and the mast track came away. So we had to take the main down, and it was about 3 or 4 days of repairing the mast tracks with the guys up the mast in kind of 50 knots of breeze. And that was awesome to see, because first of all, everyone has that kind of sinking feeling of, right, we're in the middle of nowhere, what do we do? And it all went quite quiet. But then after a few minutes, everyone starts coming up with a plan, then the humour comes back, and then everyone gets on with it. So that was really exciting to document. And it was awesome because, you know, usually you're going along up in the Southern Ocean between kind of 25 and 35 knots, slamming into the waves. The boat is pretty much underwater, so it's quite hard to work up on deck to have your camera in a housing, and it can be a bit tricky. But for the first time, you know, they had to slow down, so, you know, the albatross were just swirling around us. It was really incredible to see, and you could really feel the power down there.
And were there any legs in particular that you really enjoyed and you'd like to, you know, potentially go back and sail again or see again?
I think it would just be the Southern Ocean, really. That was, you know, they're definitely the tougher legs. It's just such an amazing feeling to be in the middle of nowhere on a boat that is moving at such speed, and just the size of the waves is, it's really hard to document how big the waves are, but that is incredible. And if you're with a good team, you know, it's so much fun. It's really exciting. And it's, for for us as the onboard reporters, we ran our own shifts. So, you know, the sailors were doing 4 hours on, 4 hours off, where we could be a bit more lenient or, you know, work when we wanted. So it made it a little bit easier on us. So, but that was great. So you really could see how hard these guys were working. It was incredible.
And you mentioned you can work on deck. Where were you working most of the time?
So you can work on deck, but it's you're getting dressed into all your wet weather gear, and then you're putting your camera in the housing, going up on deck, trying to get a few photos, a bit of video, and then you'd probably try and hang out with the crew for a little bit, have a bit of a chat and a yarn, and then you'd be going back down below. And we had an edit desk at the back of the boat, and so you plonk yourself there and try and edit a video. But it's like trying to edit a video on a roller coaster. It can be pretty rough, and you're just being thrown all around the place, which can take a wee while to get used to. And the first kind of 12 hours of a leg, if it was rough, sending off those first few videos was usually pretty horrid. Yeah.
And your father obviously completed the race 5 times, won it once. How important was it for you to kind of follow in his footsteps?
I'd never really thought about doing it before. And I spoke to one of the previous OBRs, Kiwi, called Hamish Hooper. And he just said, you absolutely love it. And he was talking about all the pros of it. And, you know, I guess, first of all, it was a job. It was a job for a year. And, you know, usually I'm used to short-term freelance work. So it was nice to have a year-long contract. I think the more we got into it, and the further we sailed, the more I really enjoyed it and realised, you know, how much fun it was. And I could see why he kept going back to do it, you know. And that for me was really special. It was he says it gets into your blood, and it really does. And just being out in the ocean, you know, that was really exciting.
And more recently, you've been involved in the Five Deeps expedition. What have you been doing with that project?
So I was part of the camera crew, or the camera team, who were filming the expedition for Discovery, or Discovery Channel. And so we followed the crew and Victor as he went round the five oceans, diving to the deepest point. And that was a completely different project. It was very, very cool from the science side of it and the technology. And the submarine has just revolutionized kind of full ocean depth travel, I guess. You know, over 60 years, the Mariana Trench has been dived to the bottom 2 times. And within the last year with this sub, it's gone down, I think, 6 or 7 times suddenly. So, you know, that was really fun to watch and see how they progressed as well. When they first started diving, you know, they couldn't handle much swell. They were having all kinds of issues getting the sub in and out. But by the end, it was a very slick operation. Yeah, it was exciting to watch and, you know, really quite groundbreaking. Listening to Victor as he was getting down to the deep, it felt like you were watching astronauts get to the moon. It was exciting.
And what were some of the kind of challenges or difficulties of capturing those moments?
Well, for us, you know, a lot of the moments happen in this sub that is 36,000 feet below the water. So it was all about a lot of remote camera stuff and making sure, A, that it would keep working, and B, that it was safe in the sub. We had our own weight allowance for the equipment we had to put in there. So a system had to be designed for that. And then some of the areas were pretty rough when they were launching the sub and trying to get Victor back on board. You know, he would sometimes fall in the early days. It's got a lot slicker now. But that, you know, those challenges are great to film from our side. It makes it, you know, for an exciting program.
And did you have a particular highlight of following that expedition?
For me, it was, going up to the Molloy Trench, which was off Svalbard. So that was the last trench to do, which isn't the deepest in the world, but it was up right in the Arctic. So we were diving kind of within ice floes. And then we had a bit of time looking around Svalbard and filming there, which had always been somewhere I'd love to have gone. And so it was great to be on board this amazing research vessel, going around with an amazing crew, getting to film it.
Amazing. And it's not just capturing challenges. You've done a few kind of challenges of your own. In 2012, you were part of a team that rowed from Australia to New Zealand. What was the motivation behind that?
The motivation for me was one of the crew had dropped out in 2010. They just wanted me to get some footage of them rowing over me. I was going to get some underwater shots of them. But then we started talking, and the guys were very strong rowers, but they didn't have much blue water experience. And I'd rowed a bit at school, and so thought I'd just, you know, I'd come and try it. Got on with the guys really well. It's never been my dream to be an ocean rower. I kind of fell into that, but it was a very memorable expedition.
So how much training did you do beforehand?
I was training for about a year. I was living in New Zealand at the time doing my master's. So it was about a year and a half or so of training and eating a lot, trying to put on a lot of weight before we left. A lot of rowing with the guys, and whenever I could. I felt a bit bad for the guy I was making a film with then at uni, because I was just constantly eating and constantly trying to work out, which, yeah, I don't think he enjoyed that much.
And how long did it take you in the end? Because you now hold the record, I believe.
Yeah, so we still hold the unassisted record, which we set in 51 days. And we were aiming to get from Sydney Harbour Bridge to Auckland Harbour Bridge, which we did in 54 days. But one of the crew wanted to get off early, which I don't blame him. So we let him off in the Bay of Islands. And then the three of us carried on down to Auckland. But we got across, we were halfway in about 15 days. So we thought, great, 30 days, that sounds perfect. But then we just kept getting hammered by storms and kept getting pushed back. And if you look at our track, kind of get across halfway quite well, and then it just goes round and round and backwards and backwards and backwards. And you can't go forwards when you're rowing if the breeze gets above kind of 4 or 5 knots. So you just have to hunker down inside. And we had some big storms come through, and you just have to lie next to each other. And we had 9 days stuck once, and then 5 days, and then a 4 day stretch. So that was pretty challenging. Really, when you look back on it now, it was fantastic, but at the time it was, you know, such highs and lows every day. It was pretty horrible, really.
And how do you think it compares to some of the kind of big crossings you've done sailing? Do you think it was more challenging, that kind of just not moving anywhere?
Oh yeah, it was horrible. And yeah, especially you just can't go anywhere. Sometimes you just get pushed. You're at the complete, you know, you're just getting pushed around by nature. You can't do anything. So it's very much more a mental battle. Going into it, everyone had said, oh, it'll be kind of 80% physical and 20% mental. But I would completely flip that around and but it was 80% mental, because it was tough work. But we laughed, you know, we laughed a lot. And inside our boat was just this foam matting, so that if we rolled around, it wasn't too, you know, you could bash into it and you're right. And just this grey. We started off, me and Andrew shared our cabin, and about 2 weeks in, our thermos had stopped working, so we couldn't have any hot food or anything. And he drew this little alien picture of an alien by a campfire. I think we were maybe starting to lose it a little bit. But by the end, the whole of our cabin inside were covered by these little drawings that would just make us laugh a lot. It was very funny. So, you know, humour was a big part of that. And I think I learned that probably the hard way on that one. It was, yeah, you need to be able to laugh at what you're doing.
And you mentioned that you deliberately put on weight beforehand. How much did you lose doing the challenge?
I lost 18.5 kgs over 54 days. And I put on about 10 kgs. So I was pretty light by the time I got off. It took a while to kind of get back to my usual weight.
And have you been back in a rowing boat since?
Just a little dinghy. We had two guys about 3 years ago, me and a friend pulled out two guys from the harbour here who'd fallen in the winter, and the only boat I could get to was a little rowing boat, so I rowed out to them and got them in. I said to the guys, I was rowing them back, and I was like, oh, you know, a few expletives, I didn't want to row again.
Brilliant. And your latest challenge is the Ocean Kite Project. Can you explain a bit of the basics about what you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, so I had this idea about when I was 18 or so. I wanted to kite surf across an ocean. I guess a slightly mad idea. But ever since that, it's grown. And the guy that I'm doing it with, Jake Jeffries, we've just been experimenting with the possibility of crossing an ocean at speed powered by kite. There are various kite boats around the world, some very eccentric people, some, you know, some people trying to revolutionize travel. There's just these small pockets of people trying to do it. And so we've been messing around with kites and doing a lot of testing. And we want to, yeah, cross an ocean as fast as possible using kite power as our main source.
And you currently have got an America's Cup hull. How did that come about?
Yeah, so we have one hull of an AC-45 that came about during the Volvo. I was filming one of the teams, and they were training in the gym at Ben Ainslie's base. And from the windows in the gym, you could see down into the big warehouse, and there was three of these boats just all wrapped up in plastic. And so I was very interested, and we took one of the designers sailing later that day, and I just started questioning him, and he said, oh, well, we need to try and do something with them as part of our sustainability agreement. So then I got hold of the sustainability officer, and we talked for a while and made our case of why it'd be good to give us one of these hulls. Yeah, they ended up giving it to us, and we've been testing with it and playing around with it for a couple of years now.
And what's your kind of ultimate end goal? What do you think might be possible?
The ultimate end goal, I think, would be a Jules Verne attempt, but that's way down the line. With this project, we want to do the Atlantic crossing, which is the record's currently set at 39 days, and we want to at least half that. We want to try and do it a lot quicker, just to show people kind of the power of the kite and, you know, the potential for it to be used on other boats and ships to cut down on fuel to make it more sustainable.
And why is a kite able to be that much more efficient and give you that much more speed?
So it can do in certain situations. It can be a very small ecosystem to put onto, say, a big boat, and we can reach higher winds. So you can actually scale the kites down a bit if you can get up into that high altitude, and they can just continuously go. You can set them into a pattern so that they're always providing power. So it's pretty exciting. There's still lots of challenges to overcome. You know, it's currently a research project, but we're getting to the point where we could go across the Atlantic safely and at speed with our system and setup. Yeah, it's, you know, it's for us, it's a really exciting challenge. We can't wait to see where it's going to go to.
So how far off do you think you are of that first Atlantic crossing attempt?
Ideally, we'd like to try and do it within at least 2 years. If we could get all the funding we needed, then we could do it. We could do it spring next year. You know, we've pretty much built the boat. We just need to do a bit of development. And our dream is to get her foiling as well. So obviously, but that just requires a bit more development, which we've started. We'd like to be able to speed that up, really. The kite system and how we steer the kite is pretty much there. So yeah, and we're doing testings on a little bed whenever we can and learning a lot from that as well.
And what have been some of the biggest challenges that you've sort of had to overcome with it?
With the kite, it's been the launching and retrieving are some of the main issues, as if the breeze is below kind of 12 knots or so, or maybe 10 knots, the kite it can be quite a pain to get up in the air. So we've been developing lots of techniques to get the kite up in the air, and now we can do it in, you know, if the kite will fly in kind of 5-6 knots, we can get her up, which is really exciting. I think using a kite is the main source, but also having a very good electric engine on board means that having those two power systems is really exciting, because we can continuously just keep going with those two. Even if the wind drops below the lowest speed that the kite would fly with, we can bang on the electric engine, which would power us for a few days, or at least till we find some wind, but while keeping the kite up in the air, trying to reach kind of higher altitude winds.
And one of your father's old friends, Tony Ray, is an advisor on the project. That must be a nice sense of familiarity.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, he's based in New Zealand, so we kind of speak occasionally about it. And, you know, once we get the full funding, it's going to be really exciting to have him on board. And he's been a great figure in my life, having grown up kind of around him and stuff. It's been really nice to have.
Brilliant. Well, we'll look forward to seeing the Atlantic attempt, hopefully quite soon.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you joining us today.
Cheers. Fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.